This podcast is not safe for work and will feature movie spoilers. It will feature scenes described of a graphic nature. It will contain language which most listeners may find offensive. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. I'm your host Duncan McLeish, welcome to the show. Up on this episode we are continuing our countdown of my top 20 horror movies of 2023. This week already we have dropped our first part of this four-part series. We're counting down numbers 20 through 16 on that list. This episode here is obviously continuing that countdown on. It'll be 15 through to 11. And then next week you get the final two parts of this series. One episode will cover 10 through 5, or 10 through 6, sorry, and then 5 through 1 on the final episode respectively, and that will conclude this series as a whole. And then we get into all the fun stuff that I'm really looking forward to doing for you guys in 2024. Now, as always, with these reviews, there is a good chance I'll spoil a detail or two, so if you have not checked these out before, then please, 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 please exercise caution before you jump in to the movie reviews. As always, there is a caveat that I throw out with these top 20 lists. I'm based in the UK, so the movie has to have been released in the UK in 2023 in order to count on my list. So if you're in another part of the world and that movie only played the UK and didn't play elsewhere, very sorry for that. Or I was invited to a screener. Now I get invited to a lot of screeners for movies all over the world. So there is a good chance if this was released in the US, for example, I got a screener but it hasn't been released in the UK. Then once again, sorry, not a lot I can do about that. And the last one is, if this played at a film festival that I attended, and it's only ever played at that film festival, but did play in that film festival while I was in the UK, then once again, many apologies for that as well. I did note there have been some comments since the last one that all these movies should be available in the previous segment as of February. So Here for Blood, which was a title that I wasn't aware of its release schedule, is being released on Screenbox. Pensive is apparently already available on Screenbox as well. So yeah, every movie should be available now. And I'm kind of hoping that's the same for this segment here. In this rundown from 15 through to 11, there are probably arguably the biggest cluster of cinematic horror movies, i.e. movies that played in cinemas in the UK, then I think I've had in a list for a while. Yeah, I tend to be more into the indies and more into the art house horror, but there was, for better or worse, a good collection of cinematic theatre horror that came out this year, and this list, or this part of the list, shall certainly cover that. As always, you'll get a small clip for the movie before we jump into it, and with that in mind, let's kick off with number 15 on my list. Number 15 on my list is Saw X. This is the 10th installment in the Saw franchise. It is directed by Kevin Grutter and based on the screenplay by Josh Stolberg and Pete Goldfinger. The synopsis for this one, as listed on IMDb, is a sick and desperate John travels to Mexico for a risky and experimental medical procedure in hopes of a miracle cure for his cancer, only to discover the entire operation is a scam to defraud the most vulnerable. Bill, a brand new Saw movie landing in 2023. To be honest, I didn't really see that coming. I kind of thought after Spiral we were down and out, but then I also felt the same with the movie that preceded that, where I was like, yep, that we are done with this series. We have like ran out of ideas, because in theory the story had kind of concluded and it was kind of going back in on itself, like the snake that eats its own tail. I'm not a huge fan of the Saw franchise. I really did like that first one when it came out, and I think over time, the more I've watched it, the more I realise that my enjoyment is actually predicated on the twist at the end, and very much like a movie like The Sixth Sense. Once I kind of know that, repeat viewings are no longer thrilling, engaging, they work for me less. What's kind of interesting about it is my favourites in the franchise are the direct two that preceded it. So you essentially have Saw 2, which is a movie that picks up right from where Saw finishes, and the one after that, which is Saw 3, which runs parallel to Saw 2 in terms of the timeline. I find those as kind of fitting ways to get rid of the John Kramer character, which I love Tobin Bell, great actor, but like the motivation for the Jigsaw Killer has always been one where I kind of feel like it doesn't make for a great horror movie for me. As the franchise went on, it seemed more and more about trying to be clever. And I know a lot of people hold out a lot of stock for how clever it is, but I think if you write a story full of gaps, which this franchise is known for, you can basically fill it with anything you want kind of post the movie, and all of a sudden it seems like clever writing. I don't think for any 1 second there was a grand, you know, 8 movie arc written out and, you know, all the stuff fitting neatly into that like a jigsaw. I actually think rather it was an exercise of how can we squeeze more blood from this stone, of which they managed to do a lot longer than anyone thought they would. At one time, a hugely financially profitable franchise that seemed to dwindle out. The second to last movie that we got was a kind of future version of events, but kind of playing off as if it was happening in the present day. And then we got Spiral, less that can be said about that, the better. That was a kind of spin-off Saw story that never really worked at all, and to be honest, was probably never going to work. Saw X sees us take a prequel route to bring back Tobin Bell, which I don't understand why we're doing it this late in the day. And to be honest with you, it's a frustrating watch for me. It appears 15 on the list because actually, I imagine had this happened a lot earlier in the franchise, this would have scored a lot better for me, but there's been a lot of road that's been towed with not only flashbacks to the Tobin Bell character, of which we got loads. Remember that one where it said, you know, he was younger because he was wearing a baseball cap? You know, hello, fellow children. this one is set technically between parts 1 and 2, or technically in between 1 and 2, but are during 1, or like the timeline's very muddy. And this is the attempt for the filmmakers to make Tobin Bell realistically have some sort of full-on emotional core. No, in fact, it's one step further than that, to kind of make him feel like a semi-righteous character in his revenge arc. And I don't think we need that. Like, I genuinely don't think we need that at all. In fact, if anything, I think it does a disservice to the movies that came after it. It basically undoes a lot of the motivations for the character moving on by giving them a different light. Now, I know what you're thinking, Duncan, those early movies all follow that template, and this explains why it acts that way. And you're kind of right, but then there was a whole series of movies that came after that that kind of bounced their way back to show more of why he acted the way he did. And in that capacity, it doesn't really work all that well. I mean, it's, as a standalone story, it's kind of fine. It has a kind of weird kind of law-abiding citizen approach to the kind of, actually, I feel relatively just about this guy's heinous actions. And I don't know what we're doing. And that's always an issue for me when we revisit a franchise. I predominantly don't like prequels. I don't like prequels because I feel that they tend to unpick things that have happened in later movies and leave more questions than necessarily round them out. The big issue that I also have is that... It's a big issue for me, maybe not for the filmmakers. This movie did really, really, really well. And we're getting another one. And if this is a sequel to this one, then we're just building another timeline that doesn't make sense. And to be honest, I don't want to see. I know a lot of people out there really, really, really like this movie. And that's cool. It's gnarly when it needs to be. The traps are brutal. I would argue slightly more brutal than... probably is needed in the franchise. The more brutal things tend to happen later on in the series as people and filmmakers wanted to satiate that bloodlust more and more. Kind of felt overtly mean for this time period if you're running through them in terms of a linear timeline of storytelling as opposed to release structure. But yeah, on top of that, I just kind of felt and feel like I don't really need more stories about how Jigsaw was a wronged guy when he's building traps that mutilate and kill people for, I would argue, infractions that don't need that. They're like, they don't need death to do it. And yeah, you could argue, well, Jigsaw's traps were like, lose an eye and you'll be fine. And I would say, I don't agree with that either. So, whilst it was a well-paced movie, relatively well acted. Tobin Bell is fun in the role. I do find it a bit kind of yawn-inducing after a while. I kind of just felt like I don't know what the purpose of this movie is. Undoes a lot of what the franchise did. If I cared more about the franchise, it probably would have been scored lower. I don't. And there's another one on the way, but I don't like the idea of let's try and make him a sympathetic character. It's a modern thing we like to do in our horror movies to try and make our villains sympathetic. You'll have to go and see that Don't Breathe 2 movie where a guy who kidnapped and like not only raped but forcibly tried to impregnate his kidnapped woman by the second movie is a hero ? And we're just supposed to run with that and everyone's fine with that. Yeah, people can be complicated, but a scumbag's still a scumbag, and that's how I see it. So yeah, I know plenty of people that love this. If you're a fan of the franchise, I imagine you're all in on this one. It's not a franchise I particularly like. I will be honest, I didn't even think it would make my 20 before I went into the cinema. And it did enough things to get me on board. So number 15 on my list is Saw 10. I think it's time to cover number 14.
And then he made me his familiar. Which means that I take care of Master's every need, including staff changes and arranging his special dietary requirements. Look, I didn't just jump into serving the Prince of Darkness. We had some great times.
Number 14 on the list is Renfield. This movie was directed by Chris McKay and it's based on the screenplay by Robert Kirkman, Ava Tremer and Ryan Ridley. The synopsis for this one is listed on IMDb as Renfield, Dracula's henchman and inmate at the lunatic asylum for decades, longs for a life away from the Count, his various demands, and all the bloodshed that comes with them. So Renfield comes in at number 14 for me, a movie that even the fact that Nicolas Cage was in it, I had my doubts, and I had like strong doubts for this movie, because originally it was announced we're getting a Dracula movie, and guess who's playing Dracula? Nicolas Cage, which I thought was absolute genius casting, because you never know what version of Nicolas Cage you're going to get. All you know is it will be entertaining. Nicholas Holt was then announced as a cast to play Renfield, and that was like not a red flag. He's a great actor, but I did kind of feel like, well, tonally this might not be what I'm expecting. And then that first trailer dropped and it looked like a horror comedy, which again made me think, do I want this? The trailer played like for months on the run up to this movie coming out as well, so I kind of felt like I knew the trailer inside and out by the time it actually dropped. And then I watched the movie, and at its best, I think it showcases just how smart an actor Nicolas Cage is. At its worst, it's dumb and entertaining. It doesn't really fall apart, except when you think about what the overall purpose of the movie actually is. And then at that part, it becomes a, is this a one and done? Is this linking to something? Are we looking to franchise this? What are we actually doing? But it's incredibly well shot. The action scenes are actually pretty cool action scenes. Kind of feels like a superhero horror movie. Nicholas Holt is very good in it. He's kind of bumbling, well-to-do Englishman, which, I mean, let's be honest, is kind of what Nicholas Holt is really known for playing more often than not. But it was Cage here that really elevated this for me. If you are a fan of horror cinema, I mean like a fan of horror cinema, and you have seen different interpretations or presentations of the Count Dracula character, then you are in for a real treat here. Nicolas Cage, in some of the interviews in the run-up to this one, was talking about how he really immersed himself in the classics, going back to checking out Lugosi's performance, kind of carrying that through Christopher Lee, even up to people like Frank Langella. You know, he really kind of covered the bases and tried to get as much of it in. He's obviously a huge fan of the original Nosferatu. He's also a fan of the Herzog remake of Nosferatu with Klaus Kinski. So he'd done the research, and watching this, you get a huge variety of different kind of Dracula performances. When you watch a movie like What We Do in the Shadows, you get different characters playing almost different archetypes of the vampire character on screen. That's kind of why it works, it's kind of why it's funny. And this one here, you have Cage kind of doing them all in one presentation, and by God, does it work. He really looks like he's having the best time on camera, and it translates to a very fun, very over the top, and at times quite menacing performance. It wowed me to the point where I kind of feel like we've been done a disservice by going this long in our life without a Nicolas Cage Dracula. And having now seen it, I would totally see him do it again in a second. I thought his performance was kind of great. The world they built is, you know, overtly neon, it's very over the top, but it was surprisingly bloody when it needed to, and the comedy held it through. So yeah, like a movie that I had next to no expectations on, a movie that I was kind of curious, as a morbid curiosity, to see what Nicolas Cage could bring to it, but one that from the trailers I kind of thought looked like there was a good chance it was going to suck hard, ended up actually being a movie which was hugely entertaining, and once again proves that Nicolas Cage is, at this age and this far in his career, still an actor that you can never really count out, and one that will still make you sit back and go, yeah, this guy's fucking good. With the right people and the right script, this guy is real good. So yeah, number 14 on my list was Renfield. With that out of the way, unlucky for some, here's number 13.
I had a sister. Her name was Alice.
What was she like?
She liked animals. She'd find wild rabbits and bring them home.
You're so cute. I love you.
She went missing when she was only 7.
I'm 7.
In at number 13 is Run, Rabbit, Run. This one is available on Netflix as a Netflix exclusive film, and was directed by Deanna Reid, based on Hannah Kent's screenplay. The synopsis for this one is listed on IMDb, is Sarah Snook plays a fertility doctor who believes firmly in life and death, but after noticing strange behaviours of her young daughter, she must challenge her own values and confront a ghost from her past. So Run Rabbit Run was a movie that was being touted very early in 2023 as potentially one of the best horror movies of the year. And it's an Australian horror movie, so you would think I would have jumped on this really early, but for whatever reason, it kind of languished in the background until about December last year for me, when I finally got around to checking it out. And it does a lot of things that I love about horror movies. It is against the backdrop of some movies from that part of the world which I think are just a little bit better. Relic is a really good example, Babadook is a really good example of movies that have come out that handle kind of maternal relationships and the impact of our actions, how we handle them down, the consequences there within, and how our brain, our psyche, and our mental health handle those experiences and traumas overall. I think at its best, Run Rabbit Run works as a kind of Australian version of something like A Good Night Mommy. I think it's got really good performances, is inherently dark, has like a very weighted, kind of very weighted delivery. At no point does the movie feel like it's trying to rush any aspect of the story in any way, shape or form. Actually, if anything, languishes a little bit in a kind of broody sense of mystery. I think the performances overall are great between the mother and daughter specifically, but the surrounding characters as well. And it's a story that further develops and rolls out in what feels like a kind of twisty, turny, ghosty murder mystery towards what ultimately is a kind of left to your own devices sort of ending. There's about two or three ways that I was thinking you could realistically take the very end shot of this movie, and all of them, from my perspective, felt satisfying from a narrative perspective. So it's not a case of, if you don't look at it this way, the movie completely falls apart. It wasn't like that at all. My biggest kind of complaint overall with it was I have seen other filmmakers in the last 5-6 years kind of tackle this and do it a little bit better. The aforementioned Goodnight Mummy, the Austrian movie, which was recently remade by Amazon starring Naomi Watts, is a good example of a movie which handles kind of similar thoughts and similar ideas, but just from a different perspective, but ultimately relies on the coming to terms of and realization of mother's actions, or you could argue inactions, and how those affect her child. There's a really strong sense in this movie that this could either be along the roads of a kind of reincarnation coming back to haunt the mother of actions she's done in the past, or a child that's just really perceptive to the things around her and builds this fantasy world out to a part where the mother looks a little bit too much into what's being said and ultimately is forced to kind of face the weight of her actions overall. It realistically has very little bloodshed. I think actual deaths in the movie account to about one when you take a step back and look at it. But even then, I think there's a question to whether or not, from an unreliable narration standard of what's happening in the last 15 minutes of this movie, whether or not that's fully what actually happens, or if this is the psychological break of the mother character. It's very dark and broody. Australian horror movies are really good at this now, probably since circa about Snowtown through Babadook. There's this kind of way of really grim cinema that they do. They've stretched out, mentioned The Relic earlier on, which had that kind of gothic big house feel, but this kind of has a lot of that there as well. The sets feel overtly dark. There is an oppressive sort of lighting to the movie which never really removes. There's no like shot, even in the happier scenes where everyone's outside and happy and good to go, it always kind of feels like the weight of our actions is right there and it's crippling us. So I liked a lot of it. I just never really maybe felt it went beyond the sum of quite a lot of its parts for me, and as a result of that, I did feel like I was maybe one step ahead in the movie for the majority of its runtime. The big reveal at the end even kind of felt a bit like being there, done that, wore the t-shirt. But it's hard to move away from the fact, and I remember seeing a lot of people, a lot of buzz online when it arrived on Netflix. I can kind of get that if you're not engrossed or ensconced in that world of horror, it does come as a bit left field. If you don't watch a lot of psychological kind of residual haunting horror movies as well, I imagine this feels kind of fresh and vibrant for someone that's seen a lot of them. It felt like a good interpretation or a good redo of things I've seen other horror movies do before without necessarily being one that necessarily stands out or is exceptional for the parts that it does. So overall, it scored well. It came in at number 13 for me. At the start of the year, from what was being mentioned about this one, this could have been a top 10 for sure on paper. Certainly looked that way, but there's just happens to be 12 movies ahead of this one that are better. And with that in mind, let's go on to number 12.
The worst thing about the visions was the screaming. I could hear everyone screaming. And I knew when the visions ended, the screaming was just gonna go on and on. You know what I love most about teaching kids? They believe everything you say.
Number 12 on the list is Knock at the Cabin. This is the directorial return of M. Night Shyamalan. It's based on the screenplay by Steve Desmond, M. Night Shyamalan and Paul Tremblay. The synopsis for this one is listed on IMDb. Is while vacationing, a girl and her parents are taken hostage by armed strangers who demand that the family make a choice to avert the apocalypse. So M. Night Shyamalan, love him, loathe him, kind of inevitably watch his movies waiting for the penny to drop and to get the to get the twist that we all know is inevitably coming in all of his movies. Knock at the Cabin's a weird one, and it wasn't scoring as well until I rewatched it back in December, and it actually shot up a little bit more for me. My cinema experience on this one was very well put together, very well acted, but felt like a tad predictable for a Shyamalan movie. I felt like the ending, when it eventually arrived, was kind of how I thought it was going to go, and I think initially my thoughts on that kind of knocked it down a little bit because I was like, where's the twist, Shyamalan? And then rewatching it, I think it's kind of the rod that'll break his back in a lot of respects. He has carved such a extensive career of movies that are predicated on a reveal at the end that makes you re-evaluate the movie or make you take an intake of breath, or most of the time kind of facepalm and think that's kind of dumb, that you're almost going into these movies expecting that from the start. And I suppose this movie does have that to an extent, and what's relying on for you to do here is take a stance on if weighted with some evidence and the conviction of the person talking to you, you will wholeheartedly believe in the elements that they are putting forward. In the case of this one, these kind of four riders of the apocalypse, the kind of four horsemen, which, I mean, it's all but like evident from 3 seconds into the movie when they appear that that's what these characters are there to ask for human sacrifice in order to save the world from what will be an apocalypse of sorts and all these natural disasters that come around. And it kind of pushes this couple's love, faith and belief. And I was expecting something twistier than it actually was. And ultimately it ended up in a way which is narratively very satisfying. And as a result of that, I kind of think that I first came out of the cinema kind of feeling like Shyamalan had pulled a fast one. Or maybe even taken his eye off the ball a little bit. And then on a subsequent viewing, actually, like I say, enjoyed it a whole lot more. And it's hard not to enjoy this. Maybe the weakest performance here is Rupert Grint, can't get his name right, Ron Weasley for the Harry Potter fans. And even then, he's actually good at what he does. I don't take him as the kind of gruff, southern, kind of semi-racist, homophobic American in his accent, or even his look. He kind of looks like Rupert Grint. But notwithstanding that, it had, you know, incredible performances throughout and some really cool scenes overall. It feels a lot grander, and I think sometimes the concern is when Shyamalan gets a bit too grand with scope, that's when the wheels start to come off. You'll need to look at things like The Last Airbender, The Happening, to see what happens when things happen on a global scale. Signs is probably the only movie he's done where the potential end of the world is circumnavigated in a more insular fashion around the farm. So you kind of feel like this is small, but the impact is a lot bigger. And Knock at the Cabin feels like that idea where we're dealing with things on a global scale, but actually we're all in one cabin here and we're gonna work through this here. So yeah, like I say, it surprised me on that second viewing, knowing what I knew about the movie and how it ended, that actually played a whole lot straight down the line, delivered everything I wanted. I know some people were like, this is the performance that shows Dave Bautista can act. He's fine in this one. I don't think he's amazing. Some people really kind of got on the Dave Bautista train. I think he's really good at what he is, which is a big muscle guy trying to take some fun experimental roles. But to me, I think his best performances are the ones still where he doesn't talk a huge amount. So take that as you will. So yeah, this ended up scoring a lot higher than I expected. On the rewatch, it really worked for me a lot more. I have read some people say that on the rewatch actually lessened their enjoyment, which is kind of what I expected. I expected to watch this one and see it tumble out the initial spot of 19 that it was on my list, but actually it shot right up. So number 12 for me was Knock at the Cabin, which means we have one more movie review to do on this episode. Number 11 is...
Spirits, you scream and shout and no one hears. We do now. Alicia Drake, find your voice.
It just got cold. Does anyone else feel a chill?
Is someone there?
Why? Yes.
She didn't touch the key, I swear.
She must have. You can't.
At number 11 is A Haunting in Venice. This one is directed by Kenneth Branagh and is based on the novel by Agatha Christie with an adaptation of Michael Green. This one here is the third in the kind of reimagining of the Hercule Poirot series, and this one played not only at cinemas but is currently available on Disney Plus along with all the other kind of reimagined Poirot movies, all by Kenneth Branagh, who plays Hercule Poirot in all of them. The plot synopsis for this one is listed on IMDb. In post-World War II Venice, Poirot, now retired and living in his own exile, reluctantly attends a séance. But when one of the guests is murdered, it's up to the former detective to once again uncover the killer. So yeah, I mean, once again, it's a big movie. This one didn't have a huge cinema run in the UK, but very quickly made its way to Disney Plus, as Disney movies will want to do now. I grew up with Hercule Poirot. I grew up with the novels. I grew up with Agatha Christie. My grandmother was a big kind of crime mystery story reader. I think that's maybe where a lot of my true crime fascination comes from, is that part of my life. But I grew up with Peter Ustinov playing Hercule Poirot. What's his face? Sushi playing Hercule Poirot through many iterations of TV episodes of Poirot. And, you know, I grew up with Miss Marple. Like, all that Agatha Christie stuff was always the good shit for me. And I suppose the biggest issue for me in this reimagining is not the cast. I think Kenneth Branagh is very fun as Poirot, and I think the movies always have a great cast. It's probably more that, having read the books and seen the adaptations, I know who the killers are. So watching the movies, it's never really a surprise to me. It's more a kind of, let's sit here and see how they tie this all together in this telling of the story. A Haunting in Venice is the first one that actually feels like they kind of tried to do something a little bit different and play it more as a horror movie with supernatural elements. I know there's some people that will be looking at this as being on a list of top 20 horror movies and genuinely perplexed as to why it's here, saying surely it's more a murder mystery movie than it is a horror movie, and even the reveal at the end kind of leans more into that when you understand what's actually happening in the movie. But I found myself kind of feeling a kind of old gothic, you know, the old house sort of vibe about this overall. Its setting is in Venice, which is predisposed for some of the best settings in horror movies. Don't Look Now being a great example of that. The structure of the building where the whole seance and murder mystery actually happens has a kind of gothic sinister feel about the time period as well. And the way it's set up and the twists and turns that the story takes actually proved to be on some point kind of pensively thrilling through to the next point, which was maybe a bit more a kind of straight and narrow Poirot. I think it uses and utilises a lot of horror movie techniques throughout, which elevate the storytelling. And overall, I ended up at the end of it, like, really happy with this one. Like I said before, it's not that I dislike Murder on the Orient Express or Death in the Nile either. Two movies that I thought did the job fine for what they were and, you know, delivered Poirot stories in a fashion that I enjoyed. But this one was the one where I kind of felt like, all right, you've tried something different here. The fact it was released in or around Halloween over here proves to me that there's thought process in that one. Let's take this story, let's adapt it differently, let's present it differently, and let's try and make a ghost story out of a Poirot story, like an Agatha Christie ghost story, which to me is like, it's tick tick, and it did deliver both those things. I think it's kind of went under the radar for a lot of people who look at it as, one, being on Disney Plus, which somehow demeans it, two, it's Kenneth Branagh doing Poirot and we've seen the other two, so why would I ever watch this as a horror movie, and three, I think a lot of people do look at those movies as purely murder mysteries, which I get, you can do that with this movie. But when you look at the plot devices, the mechanisms in which they're delivered, and overall the delivery of the movie in tone, I think it's hard to argue that it doesn't contain a huge amount of horror in there, which is enough in this circumstance to elevate it to my horror movie list. This one really surprised me. Like, three movies in, I think they're finally finding their stride with them. I don't know if he intends to do much of any more of these. I think they should. I enjoy them. They're always big events with great casting. And that makes me smile. It makes me enjoy them a whole lot more, and I kind of hope to see more of them. So that is my number 11. That is A Haunting in Venice, which means we can give you an official countdown now of 15 through to number 11. So at number 15, we had Saw X. Number 14 is Renfield, Nicolas Cage playing up Dracula. And number 13 is Run, Rabbit, Run, which is available on Netflix. Number 12 is Knock at the Cabin. And number 11 is A Haunting in Venice. And that brings us to the end of this episode. This is the second of a four-part series looking at my top 20 horror movies of 2023. This was covering 15 through 11. As always, if you're checking us out on YouTube, please comment, let me know. Do you agree? Do you disagree? If there's movies you think I might not have seen, please let me know. I'm always kind of keen to round out the kind of the edges of horror that I sometimes miss, because you will inevitably miss horror movies by kind of not being able to see everything, so I always build time in. So please let me know, make sure you subscribe and also like the video as well, it helps me on YouTube. If you're checking us out on Spotify or Anchor, there's always a question at the end, please answer that question and that way you can interact with me. And if you check me out on any of the podcatchers out there, so doing the audio content only, then make sure you subscribe to any of the podcatchers we're available on, that way you get access to the about 1300 episodes of Podcasts Under the Stairs, as well as all the new content we'll be swinging your way real soon. All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for checking out this episode. I look forward to chatting to you in a few days when we drop our next installment covering 10 through 6. And until then, wherever you are, whatever the time zone is, and whatever you're up to in this big bad world of ours, please take care of yourselves out there. This is Duncan McLeish, broadcasting live from under the stairs, and I am signing off.